22 dive out of the backwards high, flank left onset. Ready?
Weepees, peewees, cubs, and midgets, 10-year-old halfbacks in oversized jerseys, faking nobody, but trying to imitate the deft moves of a slick professional. 120 pounds of raw linebacker poised head-to-head with the lanky offensive end with that runny nose. Kid football. In Minneapolis, it's called the Park and Recreation Board Football Program. About 700 boys between the age of 9 and 14 signed up at local playgrounds in late August. Several hundred participate in St. Paul. They play games on the hour, after school and on Saturdays. Marge Fredrickson directs the Minneapolis Park Board program.
If a boy comes to a park, his closest recreation center, he registers there to play football, and there he is placed in a division according to his age and his weight. And it goes the peewees 10 years old and under. That would be the 9 and 10 years old, because if you see down here that they have to be 9 years old to compete in this program. So the 9 and 10-year-old plays our peewees, and they are 100 pounds or under. Now they can be 95 or 96 or whatever. Mm-hmm. But if they're 105, they have to move up to the next division, which is the 11-year-olds that go to 110. The 12-year-olds go to 120. 13-year-olds go to 130, and the 14-year-olds go to 140. And, of course, as soon as you establish this age limit or weight limit, you run into a team that has a boy that's 5 pounds, 2 pounds, 3 pounds, 5 pounds overweight, and that coach tries to get us to change the weights just for that one player. Mm-hmm. However, we've kept the same pattern now for maybe 5 or 6 years.
Mr. Strauss, what's the name of your team?
Midway Football, Blue Devils. We don't have the helmets with the Blue Devils on them anymore, though.
How old are these kids?
4th and 5th graders.
What's that, 9, 10-year-olds?
Yeah. 9 and 10.
Did you come out on the short end today?
No, we tied, 6-6.
6-6, were you pleased with the performance?
Oh yeah, for not practicing, yeah, we did all right.
Are they pretty serious about football at this level?
Varies from kid to kid. Some of them are, some of them aren't. I mean, you know, but you gotta realize they're kids,
yeah.
So.
Do you practice with them a lot?
2 days a week, hour and a half, hour.
What are the practices geared for? Are they hard work, or is it mostly for the enjoyment of getting out and running around?
Well, practices, I think, should be hard work. The game should be fun. So
I see.
Every coach differs, of course.
Uh-huh. How about you? What's your name?
Pat Walker.
What do you play, Pat?
Left halfback.
You're a halfback? Did you carry the ball today?
Yes.
Did you pick up yards?
Little.
Do you enjoy playing football?
Yes.
What's the most important aspect of the game for you? What do you like to do most?
Well, they're both about the same, defense and offense.
How about you? What do you play?
Center.
What's your name?
Jeff Ammon.
Did you have a good game today, Jeff?
Yeah, it was okay.
What was the best play that you made all day?
I sacked the quarterback.
You sacked the quarterback? Was he going back to pass?
No, he's just going to hand off.
And you got him before the handoff. You think that's pretty good?
It's okay.
You're gonna be a touchdown getter, you bet. If you wanna get a baby to bet, the fact that you are rich or handsome won't get you anything in curse. You gotta be a football hero to get along with the beautiful girl.
Most young athletes aspire for greatness, but how serious should football be for a 9 or 11-year-old? In large part, that's determined by the expectations that parents and coaches hold for the player. Both the Minneapolis and St. Paul programs are geared for exercise and fun, the respective directors say. However, well-intentioned but overenthusiastic coaches can intimidate or even physically harm a boy. They may wear pads, but under the equipment, they're just kids, tender bodies and personalities. St. Paul teams are fielded by the local recreation centers. Harold Holmgren directs the program and says overzealous coaches are discouraged.
There isn't one that doesn't come out of a rec center of some sort. And as a result, there's a professional paid employee there. So you say, hey, Joe Smith, you got a guy handling your peewees or your weepees or midgets or whatever age group that really hasn't got this figured out. And, you know, just tell this young man that, hey, this is a fun program. And don't scream and holler because the kids don't pick anything up when you scream and holler. And that's worked reasonably well. Because, again, they're coming out of a professional staff someplace. If I at Groveland send out a crackpot kid to handle my peewees, we just say, hey, you know, this isn't what this is all about. This isn't good data. And if you get the dynamic, good coach, you've got them all together. You put them in a good league, mm-hmm. and it handles itself.
Most of the coaches are there year in, year out.
Yeah, surprisingly devoted to no glory, no nothing program. And again, they're ex-kids that have played in the thing and have gone to high school and some college, and they're like, this is their bag, this is their kick.
Do you recommend how much they should be practicing with the kids?
Can't do that. Because then you're just setting up something you can't police anyhow. That's something you have to be very careful about. Yeah, we send out through the rec center directors, where all of these teams are located, what we think they should start no earlier than the 15th of August for practice, and we know some of them go out earlier.
We've done some things to try to curb that. For instance, we have what we call a mandatory participation rule. Everybody present has to play. And that has, along with limiting the number of players they can carry on a team, that has done some things for helping cut the enthusiasm of the coaches. But again, that's a difficult thing to try to do, you know, as far as the coaches are concerned. If they're there volunteering their time, and all we can try to do is to instill in them the spirit that every kid should play and that they should have an opportunity to learn. And this is basically what they're doing, is mm-hmm. teaching them the fundamentals, and they learn the fundamentals and then they start polishing it off. And that, I feel, goes all the way through up to Bud Grant, even refers back to the fundamentals once in a while.
Mm-hmm. Are the coaches screened in any way to ensure that they know the fundamentals, that they are properly
teaching? Most
of the
time, they're recruited by their community councils. And so...
So they've demonstrated some expertise
right. mm-hmm.
as football players or coaches?
Right. I suppose that's basically what they are, as former players.
Minneapolis Program Director Marge Fredrickson, preceded by Harold Holmgren, Supervisor of Municipal Athletics in St. Paul.
What I want you to do is I want you to be shooting into that line. You're not a floater. I got three guys back there now for passes.
There they are. They're right.
You're in there to go in after that guy and get him. Okay? Now, you guys are a much better team than this. We're not executing our plays. We're not even getting a chance to get the ball lately.
Play blocking good?
With the yard mark.
Blocking good. I saw you on the other end of the play was around that end, and you're playing halfback. How can you be over here blocking? The play was around the other end. How did you go around? With the quarterback keep, all three had the halfback, fullback, halfback.
Good coaching techniques are essential at any level of competition, but even more so for young people. Dr. James LaPointe is a University of Minnesota psychologist. He and fellow psychologist March Crotee study the psychological implications of sport. LaPointe's son plays parkboard football in a Minneapolis suburb. Both he and March Crotee fear that coaching at the youth level is too intense. First, Jim LaPointe.
The first thing that I would do is I would, as a prerequisite for anyone interested in being a coach, I would have those individuals be meeting on a twice or three times a week in-service program, giving them an idea about, first of all, what the youths are like, whether it's boys or whether it's girls, giving them some ideas as to what can those kids handle from a developmental standpoint. That, I think, would be the most crucial thing. Secondly, I guess then we'd look at some of the preventive sort of things that the physiological people will deal with, bone ossification, bone growth, muscle structure, that sort of thing. But I think the coaches have to have a good notion as to what their role is before they can begin to go out and organize play. That, to me, would be the number one item on the agenda, would be in-servicing the coaches to the needs of the program.
So not necessarily abolishing these programs, but possibly alerting to the coaches to the people that they're working with.
Right. I think the Park Board program services the function that it was designed to do, and that's to get a lot of activity to a lot of different people. But I think the problem has been is that the coaching in most of those instances where they've had some difficulty is the problem that they should do allude to first, trying to resolve that problem. And giving those people some ideas about sources that are available to them, alternate ways of dealing with kids, that perhaps we could help out with from our perspective here at the university, and just some general notions about how to deal with kids in a coaching setting.
Both Jim and myself certainly are behind the park boards and all the administrative people that are attempting to draw the youth into active and getting them into active participation. The problems that arise are no more than a supply and demand. There's millions of children that want to participate and very few people that are willing to give the time. So the people that do give the time have to be, you know, applauded. From the same token, the people should have sound objectives in mind. And it seems that if you went down to a park board football game, you would think you were visiting the Pittsburgh Steelers locker room, okay, or the Oakland Raiders. And we could take all the park board graduates and probably a .00001 will ever make it to a top flight college team, let alone professional working ranks. And I think if and yet the objectives would seem that this is what we're building for when coaching. So I think if these were rearranged and put in their proper function and say that the reasons we're having these programs are for participation, for health reasons, for general overall fitness reasons, then I think you would follow through with the program and maybe adjust yourself all the way down through the actual contact with the children.
Psychologist March Crotee, preceded by Dr. LaPointe. Mark Deanhart was a two-time All-American guard at the College of St. Thomas, yet only because of peer pressure did he try out for high school football. Deanhart had soured on football at age 11 because of a driven coach whose single goal was to win games.
The first year I didn't enjoy the program a great deal, but the coach I had was a nice fellow, and the kids that I played with I enjoyed, and I went back with the idea of being with the same group of people and the same coach, and they decided that I was good enough to play with a bunch of older kids and to play with a coach who was a little bit more intent on winning some football games. And the sorts of practices we went through were very unenjoyable. I right then just decided that I'd had enough. I went there for one practice and I left. And I really had a difficult decision then when I decided I wanted to try it again in high school, because I had had such a bad experience originally with football. I thought it would be the same way, and it was a great deal of peer pressure, I think, that got me back into the game. I wouldn't have chosen to do so on my own because the experience had been that bad.
Could you comment generally on the quality of coaching that you've observed at the playground level?
I think it's getting better, and I think that it has been getting better simply because of all the attention that's been directed to the abuses that have been evident in the past in park board programs, not only football but all other types. I think in my era, all coaches suffered from the Vince Lombardi image. Every coach thought they had to pattern themselves after the Lombardi style. And it's understandable. Kids look up to great athletes, coaches look up to great coaches. But most coaches didn't realize that when you're looking at Lombardi, you're looking at a professional coach who's concerned with nothing more than winning, and justifiably so at that level, when that's what his job depends on. But they started to instill the same sort of attitude in the kids, and I think that I saw a great similarity in the psychological approach of coaches at the park board level to the hardline, abusive sorts of tactics that coaches at a higher level were using at that time. I think that's passed, and I think it's a very good thing that it has, because I think that was the most detrimental sort of approach to younger children. They don't need to be turned off to athletics at that level by having the coach screaming at them for mistakes they make because of their inexperience. And I think now I can see an improvement at that stage of the game, but I think it's also an extremely impressionable age and one in which a coach plays a major role. And whatever he does, whether it's a good approach or a bad approach, will last, stay with the kid and have a lasting effect.
Good pitch out of the tee, flank right on one. 26, good pitch out of the tee, flank right on one. Ready?
Bang!
How can football be a good experience for a young boy? How do you keep the kids from lamenting a loss or rejecting sports if things go poorly? Psychologist Jim LaPointe recommends that alternative goals to winning be established.
The program that I see my son in, I see as being a very outstanding program where each athlete, 10 years of age, has to play a certain percentage of the game. So what it reduces there, it reduces the friction between parents and coaches. But the kind of thing that I'm seeing are putting the kids on the spot. You know, either you make the goal in hockey and we lose, or you make that touchdown and we lose. And it becomes a win-lose situation. You know, if the kid doesn't produce, he loses. And I think what we should try to do is set up alternatives where the kid doesn't have to be put in a win-lose confrontation. You know, he has other alternatives. You know, I've done the best I can, coach, and I just didn't make a first down, or I didn't make a touchdown. And I think that the coaches have to understand that for a 10-year-old, that's perhaps the fullest of his potential at that developmental level. And that's the problem. The coaches might not understand what's the expectation of a 10-year-old, because they're dealing, their whole background has been athletics, and they forget what it means to be a 10-year-old. So they're trying to fulfill their fantasies, perhaps, through the years of a 10-year-old kid. And I think what we'd like to allude to there as well, that winning in some forms can take the shape of personal goals. For example, our hockey team may have lost 10-3, but it's the first time we scored 3 goals. And in track and field and in gymnastics, for example, very good examples of where people who actually are classified as a loser by total score may have indeed been a very good winner. The runner who's reduced her time or his time by 2 minutes is a significant accomplishment for that individual. But again, because of the way our society has reference to scores, it's not whether or not we made any personal accomplishments, it's whether or not, you know, the score at the end of the game shows we won or shows we've lost.
What's your son's name?
Over here?
Yes.
Kurt.
How old is he?
8.
Does he enjoy playing?
Yes, he does.
They hit with some ferocity out there. Are you ever concerned that he's going to come home lame or aching?
Yes, I sometimes am, that he's, you know, worried that he's going to get hurt. That's why I do like to come to the game, so if anything would happen, we'd be here.
I see, but you can't, do you ever try to talk him out of playing?
No. If that's what he wants to do, we're with him.
Uh-huh. What position does he play?
Several different ones, but he's one of the youngest ones on the team, so he doesn't play as often as, you know, some of the others. Guard, he's usually on the defense.
Do these kids practice pretty hard?
Yes, they practice every night for an hour or two.
Every night after school?
Generally. Maybe one night they don't have practice, but...
If you had your preference, would you rather see him playing soccer or doing something that didn't involve so much contact?
No, maybe it's because I'm not real familiar with soccer. I mean, I've watched it and I do enjoy it, but I know football a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. You enjoy watching him play?
Mm-hmm. I kind of like these little games where you can, I always walk up and down the field and get behind where, so I can see where the ball is and what they're doing.
Parents comprise the vast majority of spectators at park board games. Some love to watch their boy play. Others cringe and just hope he doesn't lose a tooth or turn an ankle. What they see is a variety of playing style, a hodgepodge of plays and misplays, and a lot of whistleblowing. Sometimes when the younger kids play, the scene resembles just that, unorganized activity, with the officials tied up just trying to position them properly on the other side of the scrimmage line. A parent logically might ask if park board football will actually help prepare his child for high school ball. Former player Mark Deanhart, now a college coach, does not oppose some form of organized games for 11 and 12-year-olds. However, he doubts that they can retain proper skills at that level.
I don't think it's possible to teach kids at that age the football skills that they'll be using at, say, the high school and the collegiate level. It's simply a matter of development, physical development. The kids aren't able to execute the sorts of things that you'll have to have them do at a later stage of life. The best part of football at that age is that you can get a group of kids together and provide them with the opportunities to play. Whereas if there was no organized football program, they may not be able to get that number of kids together to be able to have a football game, an actual football game.
Mark Deanhart of the St. Thomas College staff. He found that often the park board players were improperly instructed.
It seems that we oftentimes have to start over even with the kids who have had extensive experience. And in my experience, I found that it's oftentimes better to get a kid who has not been taught anything improperly, and then we can teach him right from the start.
Do you find that that's often the case, that what they have learned really aren't the skills that they're going to need, and that they've picked up bad habits?
Sure. You watch most recreation games, and there is very, very little emphasis on skill development. You watch them practice, and they don't teach, for example, blocking techniques or tackling techniques or, the sort of mechanics that one would have to learn. They give the ball to the fastest kid, let him scoot around in with it, and that's about it.
Is it even possible for 8, 9, 10, 11-year-olds to pick up those proper techniques? Even if somebody was there who could teach them, are they able to grasp it?
Probably not. I think that perhaps by the time they're in 8th grade, 9th grade, then is about their readiness level.
McCormick says that overexposure to football for a park board star may kill his desire to play later on.
Sure, they've been the big hero, and they've experienced the adulation of their peers and the adults in the community, and they find out that by the time they get to high school, the other kids have caught up with them in development of strength and size and so forth. And, it's hard work for them. They don't want to put in that kind of effort, to stay ahead. So they take the easy way out, a lot of them.
Shakopee coach Jim McCormick adds that the best high school football player is often the boy who developed later than the Little League star. That player often must work harder to develop his athletic prowess. He was not subjected to all the admiration. Consequently, he will not need it later as a reward for playing sports and staying in shape. Once again, Mark Deanhart.
As I went along, I was thankful that I hadn't played at an earlier age, because I saw many of the kids who had were becoming disillusioned and becoming tired of the sport. Their parents had been had encouraged them into the sport at a younger age, and they had pushed them all along, and by the time it had reached the high school level where they were reaching a certain amount of independence, they found themselves rejecting that the sport simply because it was a throwback to their past, where they had been pressured in by their parents and had been subjected to some experiences that weren't the sorts that they would have chosen for themselves. Whereas in my case, in the high school level, it was completely a matter of my choosing to go back into the game, and I felt no compulsion to stay with it. I wasn't being pushed by my parents, and I didn't have a long history of having played the sport, and I think that, if anything, it was probably an advantage to me.
Former player Mark Deanhart. Many parents encourage their son to participate in football, but I spoke recently with one dad who said his son is free to pick his own sports.
I just moved in the area here about last year, so this is the second year my son's playing football, that's about all.
What's your boy's name?
Jimmy Hyber.
What position does he play?
He plays guard on the offense, and on the defense he plays middle linebacker.
There's a pretty, there's quite a difference in the size of these kids. How big is your boy out there?
He's probably small. He's on the smaller side than compared to the rest of the kids. But he's pretty solid. He's pretty well built.
Does he enjoy playing football, or does he do it because the rest of the boys do it?
No, he enjoys it because I never have to get him up in the morning to go to practice. Or I never have to help him. Uh-huh. He's always ready to go, so he likes to play football. He enjoys it. Most of the kids that he plays with are all in his class, and they all play the same sports together, so that's probably why he plays a lot.
Do you think that the program here in St. Paul is fairly well supervised, and that the coaching is pretty good so that the kids do are attended to pretty well?
Yeah, the program that they have at Northdale is real good. They always have a good turnout of kids, and they always have plenty of coaching. But now as far as the other playgrounds go, I noticed that some of them are a little short-handed on kids, but Northdale always has plenty of kids, always have enough for two teams in every sport they play. Have a real good program there.
Does it trouble you at all that your boy is involved in football, especially at this early age? Do you have any fears or doubts about injuries or mental beatings that he might take playing with bigger boys?
No, because if he does, then he comes and tells me. You know, and I played him all my life, so that's why I want him to play. And it's better than having him just standing around doing nothing. So that's why I get him up and get him out there and play.
Would you rather see him in a non-contact sport, soccer or track or something like that?
He don't like it. I don't know if he'd enjoy it or not, but he likes football, so that's what I got him playing. If he wants to play something else, he can. He's welcome to.
You don't put any pressure on him to do anything
in the way of
sports?
Because then he might not enjoy it. So I just let him play the sports he wants and try to help him out in the ones that I know best. If he wants to play something else, he's welcome to it.
Earlier, Marge Fredrickson discussed age and weight limitations for the Minneapolis program. Harold Holmgren says the categories are roughly the same in St. Paul. There are also position-by-weight rules within a division to ensure the large do a minimal amount of stomping on the small.
In our 6th and 7th, they form a team. Okay, there's a maximum weight limit of 120 pounds for the ball carriers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the coaches, after the first week, and we put a preview out, and we have an opening round game trying to match apples with apples, and they will... I'll coach one team, you coach another. Okay, after the first week, you know who your fullback is going to be, et cetera. So, and I know who yours are going to be, and you know who mine is. So we meet before the game. This is theoretically. Hopefully this will work that way. And you say, well, I think your kid is over. We're 120 pounds. I want to weigh him, and I want to weigh this halfback. And that end looks too big. Okay, so I weigh three of your players. You pick whatever you want to weigh of mine, who are potential ball carriers. If they weigh, the scale is available at the site. So if they can take their shoes and their helmet off, and if they make that 120 pounds, they can be ball carriers for that particular week. If they can't, they can still play, but they have to be interior linemen.
Oh, they can't carry the ball if they exceed that weight
right.
limit.
Right.
Okay. What happens if my quarterback gets hit throwing the ball and your defensive lineman picks it off and he weighs 140 pounds and starts churning up the field?
That's a good defensive play. That you can't do anything with.
Harold Holmgren of the St. Paul Municipal Athletic Department. Sports psychologist March Crotee finds that weight categories can be psychologically limiting.
Classic individuals, you have an 11-year-old that weighs 180 pounds and automatically he becomes a tackle or a lineman. Now, certainly he might weigh 180 pounds, but psychologically he might be a lot less mature than his weight. And as well, his bones might be a lot less mature than his weight. But these are the kids that are always put on the bottom of the pyramid, or at tackle, or at center. And psychologically, they might want to be someplace else. They might not even want to be there at all. And yet, certainly, of the 3 million participants we have in Little League that go through Little League registration, very few children, I would say, would rush out there and sign up. It's the parents that sign them up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, from the standpoint of placing them in a situation of competition, I think competition by two people who understand the ramifications of it, which I think 10-year-olds can understand, if instructed properly, can put competition in its proper context, and thereby having both people benefit from competition. However, if we eavesdrop in a T-ball game or a Little League baseball game, very seldom do you find where two teams can come out a winner. You find a mutually exclusive goal. Only one team can be a winner. The other people are shut out. And this is what I think is harmful.
Now this is a semi-violent sport. Now let's play it that way. Let's get a little tougher out there. This is where you get all your aggression out. Then all week in school you can be as mellow as can be. Out here, you guys get it all out. Then you can go home and you'll be mellow at home. But let's get tough and let's play a good game. Grit your teeth out there a little bit.
Buckle down, win Saki, buckle down. You can win Saki if you knuckle down. If you break their necks, if you make them wrecks, you can break the hex, so buckle down. Make a ball, win Saki, make a ball.
Football is a rough game at any level. However, there is a markedly lower incidence of serious injury at the Little League level. Injury, that is, resulting from ferocious contact. The hitting at age 10, 11, and 12 is probably not as intense as in the high schools. Dr. Larry Russ is a top college trainer in the Twin Cities area.
They virtually have the same potential for injury as any other athlete at the more mature level. It's just that because of the lessened nature of physical contact that the incidence would be markedly less. Oh yeah, they'll have their knee sprains, ankle sprains, and concussions of varying degrees, just as any other football player.
If an injury is incurred at a younger level, can it be assessed whether it does more damage because the body is still in a developing stage, or is a young man able to shake off an injury quicker than his collegiate counterpart might be able to?
Not necessarily. When you have these young people in varying degrees of development and maturity, they have growth centers, bony growth centers that are still soft, very vulnerable to blows, and also we call the overuse syndrome. Whereas if you have a coach who is a great one for this preseason conditioning and in-season conditioning, where the kids are instructed to do a lot of running, and where the feet and so forth are hitting the ground hard in a repetitious fashion, then these growth centers in and around the knee joint, hip joint, are exposed to that kind of overuse, and they can break down. And if the kid is constitutionally not too well put together, he's liable to break down in some of these areas. Mm-hmm. So that in itself that's an overuse kind of injury, not even related to a blow. And then if he sustains blows and hard activity in the contest, that area is going to break down all the more. And then their bones, of course, are in the process of lengthening, vertical growth, and so forth. And such areas as the thigh bone, the femur, the tibia, fibula of the lower leg, in and around the pelvis, the upper extremities, forearm, and so forth. These bony areas are vulnerable to damage, such as fracture, with mm-hmm. if the kid should happen to sustain a hard blow, catch a helmet to the arm or to the leg. Clavicular, that's the collarbone, fractures are rather frequent in the green stick fashion. They just pop like a green stick.
Russ says the young athlete should condition himself for football, just as the older player does. However, the emphasis should be on stretching and pulling instead of strenuous weight training.
So in place of weights for the little leaguer, it should be strength calisthenics. That's what it should be. Mm-hmm. A lot of sit-ups, a lot of push-ups, and chin-ups, and that type of thing. Very easy to manage. You can put up the a little bit of equipment in the backyard, and you can have this young young boy doing these kinds of repetitious calisthenics.
It would seem that would gear the boy toward an enhanced physical development overall, and not necessarily straight toward football. It's something that would be to his benefit regardless
yes.
of what sport he tried.
That's right. Because when you look at just strength calisthenics, by that I mean you're just merely using your own body weight as the resistance, you know, such as in push-ups, pull-ups. You can only do so many, and then you can't pull your body weight anymore, or push it, lift it. It has implications in the area of enhancing and sustaining a normal posture.
Doc Larry Russ of the College of St. Thomas. Marge Fredrickson of the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Department says injuries do not plague that program.
All of our center directors have a standard first aid card, And many of our staff do too. I mean, the part-time staff. And we are probably in the city of Minneapolis 3 or 4 minutes from any kind of emergency help. Mm-hmm. And so if there is an injury that is serious, they leave the player right where he is, and we call our park squad, who can be there within just a few minutes, and they in turn get the ambulance for us. So it's, we had no rain, if you remember, last year from middle of August through October, which made the turf pretty solid. And many of the injuries we got last year, we felt were from that hard surface. The cleats catching and twisting, that kind of injury. Not serious, but twisted knees and ankles that wouldn't have happened if there had been a little give to that turf, you know.
Is it mandatory that the boys have the approval of the parents before they join a team?
The parents, yes, we ask for the parents' approval, and in most cases the parents come with them when they register. So that's, or there's an original registration card that has a parent's signature on it.
Mm-hmm. And it, must it be determined that the boy be in good health before he play also?
I don't think we don't check that as a rule. You
but
know?
You've asked, figure that if you have the parents
approval right.
that he must be mm-hmm. able to withstand the rigors mm-hmm. of football.
Marge Fredrickson of Minneapolis. Trainer Larry Russ of St. Thomas is critical of the quality of equipment used at the Little League level.
I don't think the equipment for the Little Leaguers is as good as it ought to be. Some of those helmets look like cardboard helmets at a distance. They're plastic, of course, and just... But the suspension and so forth isn't as good as we see at the high school and collegiate level. If I were to have a son playing at the Little League level, I'd be down there hand picking that helmet for fit and everything else. Some of these kids don't. They take a hit in the game and their helmet spins around. They're looking out through the ear hole, and they have ill fitting pads. And sometimes their thighs are not properly protected to protect them against bruises, and sometimes shoes ill-fitting. And I think there is an area that we should look into more seriously in the area of equipment for the youngsters. We're always looking at that at the collegiate level, high school level.
Fredrickson and Harold Holmgren of St. Paul say the quality of football equipment is good. Neighborhood and community groups keep the team stocked in uniforms and pads. But Larry Russ advises parents to inspect their boys' equipment. If you don't know how to properly equip him, consult a high school or college equipment manager. Russ says he'll gladly discuss proper training techniques and protective equipment. Russ concedes that the ratio of injuries to players is slight, but he cautions that the possibility of serious injury is always present. He described an injury incurred by a college player earlier this season. The player sustained a terrific blow to the head and was spared serious injury only because he had on a good helmet.
This kid didn't know where he was at. But getting back to the helmet, this is a superior, probably the best kind of suspension you can have. If he had had a helmet, say the old style helmet, the old leather helmet, he probably would have had a fractured skull, maybe a third degree concussion, and probably a death or a permanent disability. Now we're back down to the Little League level. There could be a situation where two kids could come on head to head, a running back and a defensive back, and smack heads. And if one of those kids has had a poor suspension, he could easily sustain a serious injury. Not only the head, but right down through the neck, because everything, that kind of a blow doesn't just stop there. This kid that I just mentioned, who had the scalp laceration concussion, he also had a very stiff neck for about 3 days afterwards, mm-hmm. which wasn't surprising. Mm-hmm. You can get such a blow that you can remove, you can alter the curve of the spine.
St. Paul Municipal Athletic Director Harold Holmgren.
Thanks to the good Lord when we get through it, and we've had some broken legs and fingers and things of this nature, but So far in my 26 year, we haven't had anybody permanently injured.
But a kid's individual insurance then takes...
It's the parent's responsibility, right.
...takes care should he be injured
in any way. And there's a permission to participate slip that his parents are supposed to sign saying that... But the courts have ruled differently, so you can't waive your rights.
Mm-hmm.
We would have a negligent suit on a careless condition that we permitted to exist. We'd get sued on it. And those have shown up more often in softball. Kid football has been very... God bless it. There hasn't been any serious injuries. That,
What about ensuring that the quality of the equipment is good?
Really can't do that. Now, our good heavy, or our big midgets, will have equipment that is comparable or better than high school. Some of our associations, through booyahs and bingo and raffles and fundraising, softball tournaments at their playground, will have 25, well, I can't speak now because I'm not that close to it, but the last batch of helmets that the Hazel Park kids bought for their, you know, the coaches bought for their kids were superior to the things that they were wearing in the high school program. But that's not always the case, but the good teams, and again, once you're into it, they replace stuff, and they are now very well equipped. When we started, there were a lot of kids that didn't wear helmets. They wore a pair of old shoulder pads and a sweatshirt. And so now even the little weepies will be somewhat equipped. But the parents still go to Kmart and buy a plastic helmet with a thin bar, you know, because they can buy it for $5 or $4.
That's potentially dangerous, too.
But that at that level, it's adequate, I think. You can't dress that fourth and fifth grader or sixth grader like you'd like, I guess.
Is the hitting less ferocious at that level, though?
Oh, I think so.
Yeah, their skills aren't anywhere close to the skills that are necessary, but you still have the talented, mature little kid banging into a kid that doesn't play very well. But through our grading system or our attempt to grade, we haven't been at this a long time, and we haven't had a serious head injury or a spinal column injury.
Harold Holmgren. St. Thomas trainer Larry Russ says coaches should not have to be responsible for first aid. He says that a person skilled in emergency care should be available at all games.
It's kind of an injustice to the coach, let me put it that way, to have him out there in a coaching situation where he is involved in the game. He's trying to figure out defenses and make offensive decisions and changes and what have you. And he's emotionally excited in the game. And then we see a situation where the kid comes off the field and he's hurt. He may have taken, a shot to the side into the loin area of the small of the back, which in which case you've got to think of the kidneys that are not as protected as other parts of the body, the spleen and so forth, possible rib fractures. If that coach is not well-versed and greatly concerned for the injury aspect, he may just tell the kid to sit down and take it easy for a little while, catch his wind or whatever, without making any kind of a checkup on the kid to find out, is there a bone sticking out through the skin? Is he in fact severely hurt? Make some kind of an on-the-field estimate as to whether or not he is in fact injured.
Is it possible?
Or if the other decision is, do I put this kid back in the game? And I think it's unfair to expect that much of a coach, because I know our coaches here at St. Thomas, they don't want to be involved with the injuries at all. They want to leave that decision to me or to the school physician. They're relieved that we are there to make those decisions. So in that regard, I don't think there's enough coverage, let's put it this way, in the management of Little League football. The coaching situation usually is well taken care of, and these coaches are well versed in the fundamentals of the game, I believe, most that I've seen at any rate. But when it comes to first aid and even emergency situations, I think some of them are not where they ought to be in the way of knowledge and, you know, proficiency to take care of these little kids. Mm-hmm. I'll give you one example. I saw a game a couple of years ago, and the little kid came off. He took a real hard shot to that soft area, the small of the back, and he was in tears. And the game was, it was a heated contest, very close. And the kid was standing alongside the coach, expecting the coach to do something for him, whatever, you know, give him some comfort. Well, the coach, while he was watching the game, he didn't even look at the kid. He put his hand under his jersey and started rubbing around his back and just kind of rubbing it, kind of soothing him, like, it's going to be all right, you know, it's going to be all right. And he didn't even so much as look at the kid. He didn't lie him down on the ground to check for tender spots, check for possible rib damage or whatever. And now that's just one instance. I'm not saying that's a frequent occurrence, but I didn't like what I saw in that particular example, that particular instance.
But so it's possible that a kid could sustain an injury on the field and be so worked up over the game that he could come off of his own volition, walk off the field, and because he's walking, it's assumed he's not dangerously hurt and could be sent back in. Would you advise then that there be someone who knows his way around the human body to always be in attendance?
Yes, that would be the ideal, and that isn't always possible or practical. It should be. That should be the way it is. I think we'll see the time as long as we have football with us and it will remain with us. We will see the time when that kind of attention would be available at any and all kinds of football games.
Some of the people interviewed during this broadcast have been critical of youth football, but all agree to an extent that competition and football can be a good experience for the young player, provided, of course, he is properly trained, equipped, and actually wants to play. All agree emphatically about one aspect of youth football. Practice and games, at least at early levels, should be geared to individual goals, exercise, and enjoyment. The player will have adequate time to hone later the skills that will make him a star. The technical director for this program was Paul Kelly. I'm Neil St. Anthony.
Remember the day he murdered Minnesota? Remember the day he picked a low Purdue? The boys from Notre Dame have never been the same. He took Wisconsin's white and red and made them black and blue instead. And look at the way he broke the heart of Harvard. He knocked the double out from Illinois. Look out, sister, here comes Mr. Touchdown, our boy. They always call him Mr. Touchdown. They always call him Mr. T. He can run and kick and throw. Give him the ball and just look at him go. Hip hip hooray for Mr. Touchdown. He's gonna be there today. So give a great big cheer for the hero of the year, Mr. Touchdown, USA. Mr. Touchdown, USA.